I'm Tina Andrew, and you are listening to Cultivating Indigenous Voices. I'm here with Native Tucsonan actor and comic creator, John. Thanks for coming into the studio today to share your story.
My name is John Proudstar. I'm a Yaqui, Jewish, and Mexican, and definitely grew up running around the streets of Tucson all my life. I started off in 22nd and 3rd Avenue, then went to the West Side. Went to Tucson High, Cholla, Catalina, got kicked out of all schools. I'd always wanted to be an actor my whole life. It had, you know, ever since I was a little boy, ever since, you know, my grandmother had to explain to me what acting was, because I was, you know, always watching TV, and I'd seen one of the actors get killed in a movie, and then I saw him in something else, and I was like, that guy died, you know? She's like, well, no, they pretend. And the way she explained it was, you know, like when you go outside and you play with your friends, that's mm-hmm. what they're doing. And I was like, you know, and they get paid for this? Like, what? You know, and I was just fascinated. I was fascinated because I think I might have been like 6 or 5. And, you know, it's when your brain's kind of figuring everything out. And we didn't have a lot of money. So, you know, I had hand-me-down toys and stuff like that. And the most available source of entertainment was comic books and TV. You know, those were the things that were just readily available to me. And I immersed myself in them. You know, it was such a great escape for me and a window to a world I knew nothing about. My world at that time was this little section of 22nd Avenue and 3rd, you know, right by the railroad tracks. And so comic books and movies played such a pivotal role in my life.
You know, you talked a little bit about what your life was like growing up here in Tucson, and you shared a little bit of a story with me about KXCI. So take us back to your teenage years. How did you get connected with KXCI?
I was in high school, and I had this buddy named Mike Sosa, and we were just like brothers, you know, when we first met our freshman year. We had heard about each other even before that. People were always saying, you know, that I had a twin and, you know, we were the same guy. And when I met him, you know, I just thought he was the coolest cat ever. And he was into comic books and movies just like me, you know, and we just became fast friends. And we had heard that there was this public radio station that everybody was listening to, a show called Cheryl Cruz, the Cruise Control Show. And it was late night. So, you know, we would listen to it when we would go cruising. And one night, Mike and I decided to come check it out. And we saw her getting out of her little car, and she had these crates of records. And we were like, are you Cheryl Cruz? And she's like, yeah. And we're like, can we help you with your records, you know? And so we helped her up into the booth, and she let us hang out. And every Friday and Saturday, we would show up and just, you know, like be these flies on her wall and help her with the records. And she eventually started showing us how to work the boards and everything. And Mike was much better at it than I was. I was just the voice. And mm-hmm. Mike had a good voice too, though. He was a great DJ. And eventually, like one night, she had a hot date. And she's like, all right, you guys are going to run the rest of the show, you know. So we ran the last hour of the show. And it was just, to us, that was just the biggest thing in the world. And, you know, Cheryl eventually gave us her slot because she had to leave, and we were 16, 17 with our own radio
wow.
show, which was just inconceivable. And so that was my first taste of a little bit of celebrity here in town. And Mike and I, we eventually went on to KXCI radio. Mike was known as Mikey Mike or AKA Cat Dog, and I was Conan. And you know, like I said, we went to work for KXCI radio, and I eventually got fired because I'm a troublemaker. Mike continued on and just had a great career as a local DJ out here.
Wow, that's so interesting. I mean, those community connections with KXCI, and thank you for sharing your KXCI story. And it's good to have you, you know, full circle.
Yeah,
here you are, you're back.
For me, man.
And you mentioned about that it wasn't actually here, it was downtown
yeah.
at the time in the early 80s.
Yeah, late, okay. Well, 86-ish, 85, 86,
oh, okay.
I think, around
yeah.
that time.
And yeah. what kind of music was the
show?
Oh,
we were playing slow jams and funk and soul. And, you know, Mike, Mike had a better knowledge of it than I did. I just, you know, I was very much about pop and all that other stuff, you know, the popular, but Mike had this vast record collection and he just knew music. And I knew what I liked because my older brothers would bring music into the house and we were exposing the community to Prince and Vanity and all these, at that time, underground music that was coming from the East Coast. And it was just, it was so amazing, you know, because that was the days people were recording. So they would call us up and say, hey, when are you going to play this song? Because I'm recording. And,
oh, nice.
We would do the shout outs and the dedications and stuff like that. And it was so amazing because, again, it was my first experience working in what people would call the entertainment business.
Yeah.
And I knew that's where I was destined. You know, I didn't know how or what I was going to end up doing.
And so what came first before when you started getting into comic?
Well, comics, like I said, had always been a huge influence on me. And I knew I wanted to do something like that. There were no books on how to get into the comic industry at the time. We didn't have the internet. It was this mystery. And I would, you know, I'd go to comic shops and I saw actual pages from comic books and they were huge. They were like 11 by 17. And I'm like, okay, so they shrink these things somehow, you know? And I was slowly learning, you know, how to do my own book. And it's when you're native, you almost feel like you have to be given permission to do stuff because there's been no one before you.
Yes.
So you're like, maybe I got to wait, you know, for Stan Lee to call me and say, okay, to do this. So I waited and waited and waited and waited, and it just wasn't happening. So one day I said, I'm done waiting, and I'm just going to start, you know, putting it out there and telling people I'm looking for an artist, or I was going to draw the book. And a local comic guy at Fantasy Comics, Charlie Harris, introduced me to this artist named Ryan Huna Smith, who was Navajo and Chemehuevi. Showed me a picture that he had drawn of Wolverine, and I'm like, wow, this guy's good, man. He's got a really cool style. And we met and talked, and I told him my idea about Tribal Force, and, you know, he was on board. And Ryan had already done an ash can of his own, like a little comic book that he created when he was in college. So we just started doing it very naively, you know, not realizing that we were creating the first native superhero comic book ever.
Amazing.
We didn't have any idea. And then we got contacted by, it was a university in Boston. They said they wanted the book in their library because we were the first. And I said, are you sure? And they're like, yeah, we're sure. We did the research.
Wow.
And then the Smithsonian contacted me and they wanted to put it into their Natives in Pop Culture thing. And because other natives were using our images from Tribal Force on their pottery, on their beadwork. And they were like, who are these characters? Mm-hmm. Everyone talked about this comic book that came out in 1996 and it was just one issue. So long story short, we got inducted in the Smithsonian Institute for being the first native superhero comic book in the history of the United States. And I was blown away because there was a part of me that, you know, obviously proud to have done that. But there was this really, it was sad because I'm like, how many other natives wanted to do this and couldn't or weren't allowed to or, you know, didn't have the resources that probably that we had. So again, you know, when Ryan and I were initially doing the book, our hope was that not only could we put this book out, but we hoped that other native creators would say, hey, if they did it, I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And now there's this huge surge of native comic books and superheroes, and there's a comic con devoted to native comics, and it all stems from Tribal Force,
yeah.
You know.
Wow.
This little book that Ryan and I put out, and it's amazing, you know, and I'm honored.
Yeah, and so Tribal Force, is it about a group or one?
It's a group
superhero.
Of native heroes,
okay.
And it all revolves around this little girl named Nita who has these superpowers. She's also a survivor of child molestation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another character in the book named Little Bighorn, and his real name is Gabriel Medicine Dog. He's Hunk Papa Sue. And he had fetal alcohol syndrome in effect, so his lungs never developed, so he can't speak, so he has to use sign language.
Oh.
And Nita is Yaqui and Navajo. So each character comes from a different tribe, and... You know, they're very modern, they're very young. So these kids have to learn about their culture in order to control their powers, because they don't know very much about their own culture, which is very relevant today. A lot of our kids don't know about their culture. And it is a big responsibility, because it's being put on their shoulders. Because as our elders die and the last language speakers die, we're looking on our young people to utilize this new technology, computers and phones and all that stuff, to preserve it. Our culture has been abused and misused and taken from us and represented by non-natives for years. And that's why our elders are so protective, because they've seen the bastardization of our culture from people who don't care about where all that comes from, what it represents. They're just thinking about the monetary gains of it or how cool it looks, you know. So it's our responsibility and the new younger generation to preserve it and educate the public on why these things are special to us.
Absolutely amazing. I love that. I love just the storyline. I mean, totally relate to as a Rez kid myself, you know. So thank you so much for, you know, having the thought to even put that into a comic and make it something that can relate to so many different people. And yeah, I appreciate that so much. So when did you start to transition into acting?
I started in high school. There was this really cute girl and I was trying to get to know her. And I would just follow this girl, and one day she was going down to the basement to the drama class, and I ended up there, and the drama teacher caught me. And she's like, "You can't be in here unless you're going to sign up for the class." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to sign up." And, you know, because I just wanted to be around this girl. And I ended up signing up. The teacher just threw me and, you know, like, "Hey, you're going to do this part." And, you know, and I started acting. And she noticed that I had something, that I had this gift of gab and that I wasn't shy. And she's like, "You should really seriously think about acting." And I had always wanted to do it. I just, again, I didn't know where to start or where to begin.
Yeah.
So that led me on the road. And it wasn't until I went to Catalina High School, and they had an award-winning drama teacher. And my first day there, she threw me in this improv scene and was just blown away. She was like, "Where have you trained before?" And I'm like, "I don't, you know, nowhere." So that kind of put me in motion that maybe, possibly, you know, I had something. But then, you know, it was that, how do I get to Hollywood? How to, because everyone kept telling me, you can't do it here.
Yeah.
So that's where it all started, you know, was in high school, and I had very lofty dreams.
You've done a lot of really good things so far as acting. How long did that take you to get to that point?
Oh my God. I did extra work for 5 years, and then I started to realize I wasn't progressing. So then I went back to my old habits, like, okay, we need to start breaking rules.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin and I were working as extras, and I said, "Hey, just so you know, our goal is to get fired." And he's like, "What?" And I go, "Yeah, we're going to get fired. We're going to do whatever we have to do to get fired from a movie." Because we had never seen anyone get fired.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially an extra. I go, "So whenever they tell us a rule, we're going to break it immediately, like right in front of their faces." So, you know, the first AD comes out and he starts talking to the extras. And, you know, he rounds us up. And first thing he tells us, he's like, "Okay, this table right here, this is for the extras where all the food is. That table with that food, that's for the stars and, you know, the day players. Do not eat there." We just beelined it right to that table, started stuffing our pockets and eating stuff. And he just runs over like, "What are you doing?" You know, like, and we just didn't care. And then he gets us back to the extras table, and he's like, "Don't bother the stars. Don't talk to the stars." What do? I go right up to the star. "Hi, my name's John Proudstar." I just start chatting with them and, you know, asking them questions about how do I get to the next level. And it got me in.
Wow.
The stars would shoo off the first AD saying, "Hey, I'm talking to this guy." Because I think they recognized, here's this kid who's truly, he wants to know about getting into this craft that I'm doing. It's not like, "Hey, can I have your autograph?" or "Can I have $10, you know? So they shared some information with me. And, you know, little by little, it started pointing to Hollywood. Like, I didn't want to go to Hollywood, but that was kind of sort of, you got to get to L.A. You know, you got to get to L.A. That's where the real stuff happens. I eventually moved to L.A., and it was scary. And I got my butt stomped, man.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I had done a couple of movies. Like, the biggest thing I had done was Young Guns 2. I was a stand-in photo double for Lou Diamond Phillips.
What?
And yeah, I quit my job the night I heard Young Guns 2 was going to be in Tucson. And I found the hotel where they were staying. And I found out through the cleaning ladies where the casting director was going to be staying, what room he was going to be in. And I was hanging out at the hotel room, and the security guard kept chasing me off. So the second night, I brought coffee and donuts. So when he showed up, I was like, ta-da, you know. And he's like, all right, you can hang out here another night, you know. And sure enough, the casting director showed up, and I was asleep at his door. And he woke me up, and he's like, I just want to get in my room. He probably thought I was this big drunk Indian dude. And I was like, hey, my name's John Proudstar. I want to work on Young Guns 2. And, you know, and he was just trying to brush me off. You know, it was like 3 a.m. and he had driven from L.A. And he's like, listen, I just want to get into my room. And I was like, man, you got to hire me. I go, you know what? I go, you guys never hire real natives, you know?
Yeah.
I want you be, you know, courageous. Hire a real native, man. And so he's like, I can't pay you. I don't have money. And I'm like, well, can you feed me? Can you pay me in food? And he was just like, fine, be here tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And I showed up the next day and I was his assistant. And then I eventually met Lou Diamond Phillips, and Lou, his hair was up down to about his shoulders and mm-hmm. mine was down to my waist.
Yeah.
And he really liked my hair. And he goes, hey, he goes, I'm going to bring this guy down from LA and I want him to copy your hair onto mine. So we sat by the pool one day and had my hair copied onto Lou's. And when the director saw us walking together, he was like, my God, you guys could be brothers. Uh-huh. And they offered me the stand-in photo double role. So I went from getting paid with food to, like, I think I was making like $300 a day, which was huge.
Cool.
Man. And they were like, can you ride a horse? And I'm like, yeah, I was born on a horse. And I had never touched a horse in my life.
Oh my goodness.
I was terrified. I'm like, oh my God. Like, they're going to expect me to do like all this rough riding. And I had to do a riding test, and I faked it good enough to where I fooled the casting director. But the wrangler, Jack Lilly, he comes up to me and goes, you ain't never rid a horse in your life. And he goes, I'll tell you what, if you come here every morning at 5 a.m. and help us unload the horses and, you know, shovel horse manure and all this stuff, I'll teach you how to ride. And he did. And thank God he did. Because
cool.
I was doing some hard riding in that film. Yeah. But I became his stand-in photo double. That allowed me to be around all the stars of the film. And I also met the writer, John Fusco, who is now this just huge writer in Hollywood. Like, he's huge.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like my college for movie making. And I was messing up big time. I was making so many mistakes and I breaking the rules like I always do. But luckily, Fusco took me under his wing and kind of sort of slowly started to guide me. And I had written a screenplay on a legal pad and I had given it to him like this huge stack of crappy papers. And I was like, dude, I want to, you know, write screenplays. And I don't know if he ever read, he probably didn't. But he came back with this list of books that I needed to read. And he asked me, he goes, did you graduate from high school? And I'm like, no. I go, how could you tell? He goes, because your control of the English language is horrible. And he goes, you have all kinds of spelling mistakes, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And he's like, you need to learn how to control the English language or it will control you. And he's like, read these books. You need to understand about script formatting. And of course, he gave me a copy of Young Guns 2. But I took it very serious. Like, you know, I was glad that he had the guts to tell me what I was doing wrong. So I had to learn how to control myself and be more professional, especially being native. I was always misjudged. And I'd gotten into so much trouble on the set. The director, when we went to New Mexico to film, the director, it was around 2 o'clock in the morning. They came to my hotel room and the first AD is like, the director wants to see you now.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God.
Dang.
And they drove me to this warehouse and there was two little director's chairs set up and this little light. And I'm like sitting there waiting for him. And it was this English director. And he comes up to me, he goes, do you know who Billy Crystal is? And I go, yeah. He goes, do you know him? And I'm like, no. He goes, well, apparently he knows you. And I was like, really?
What?
And he was doing a film called City Slickers in the city in Albuquerque. We were in Santa Fe. He goes, well, Billy Crystal had heard about this native guy who had done all this stuff on the film, who got into all kinds of trouble. Like, I had gotten into a fight with Kiefer Sutherland. I stole a car one night. I charged $270-some worth of dinners to the first AD room. I was just losing my mind. So this director's like, what are you doing here? Like, why are you here? And I just told him, I said, listen, I want to make movies, you know, and this is the only place I feel right. And I grew up watching the Marx Brothers and Peter Sellers and, you know, Carol Burnett. And I just want to be a part of this. And something resonated with him. And he goes, I'll tell you what, if you can stay out of trouble for 2 weeks, I'll let you direct a scene in this movie.
Wow.
He goes, but I don't want to hear your name. If I hear your name once, deal's off and you're fired. And I said, okay, you're on, man. So for 2 weeks, I just behaved. I didn't talk to anybody. I just you know, did my job. And at the end of 2 weeks, he let me direct a scene. And Emilio had known about all the trouble that I had gotten into. Everyone did. So one day, Emilio gets a knock on his trailer door, and it's the first AD, and he goes like, John Proudstar wants you on the set right now. And he's like, the stand-in? And he's like, yeah. He goes, what does he want me for? He goes, well, the director's letting him direct the scene today.
Wow.
So Emilio's like, you gotta be kidding me. And he comes out, and I'm sitting in the director's chair, and the director hands me his little, you know, viewfinder thingy. And he goes, all right, it's all you. And he walks away. Leaves the set, and the first AD is like, okay, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, can I see what we did? What was the last scene? And we start talking, and I say, okay, we set everything up. And Emilio's in the scene. It's the scene where he throws the table over. And I got to say action, and I got to say cut. And then the director comes back, and he's like, good job. He goes, you have a future in this business. Stay out of trouble. And, man, I felt I was flying, you know. I felt so honored. Because I knew it was a big deal to do that. And everyone else, and even my buddy Paul, you know, was amazed. Mm-hmm. But that was like this spark. I was there, you know, I sat in the director's chair, and I worked with Emilio Estevez, and I got to direct him. And as minor as it was, you know, it was just huge for me. It was like affirmation from the professionals that I had always wanted. And again, growing up native, we always think of ourselves as less, or that was a kind of sort of ingrained in us that we aren't good enough to play with the gods. And then that's in that moment where you realize the gods are just humans.
Yeah.
That we put them up there, you know, and that there is a place for us. And that was the beginning right there.
Wow. It's just inspiring, really. It is. You had it in you to discipline yourself as much as possible, work hard at that, and then persevere through that enough to get to where you're at today.
Well, what I tell kids is you have to be teachable.
Mm-hmm.
If you're teachable, you can be incredible. Because teachers, regardless whether school teachers or directors or MMA fighters, teachers are useless if you don't want to learn. But if you have a hunger to learn and you are teachable, the sky's the limit, you know. And so I tell young kids, I try not to tell them what to do, but my advice is be teachable, man. If you can be teachable, you got a shot.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. So you got your first taste of directing. Now you're considered as a writer, a producer, and a director in film. Are there any current projects that you're working on now?
Currently, no. I mean, I directed my first short film way back in 05 called Dude Vision. And I had gotten accepted into the Sundance Directors Lab as an actor. You know, I got to meet Redford and Stanley Tucci and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ed Harris. And it sent me back home with a fire that I wanted to make film. And I had met other filmmakers, and they had made their films, and they had the same excuses that I had. And it's always money, you know, with young up-and-coming talent. It's always like, I don't have the money to produce it properly, yada, yada, yada. But some of these guys had done it regardless, which made me feel kind of like, oh, man, I'm just making excuses. This guy had the same, you know, he's poorer than I am, and he made his movie. And So I came home with a fire lit under me. I had $147, and I had done so many favors for people in town locally working on their projects that I was able to get most of the equipment and staff and, you know, crew. And I had done a film for Paul Klinko, who's a local filmmaker here, and he lent me his video camera, which at the time was state of the art. And Steve Bayless, Tina Huerta did my editing. So long story short, it was a comedy. I was in it, and it was a short, and we won. We won the Arizona International Film Festival for Best Comedic Short, and I was a Native American doing a comedic role, which was just my dream, man, because, you know, like I said, growing up watching Peter Sellers and Gene Wilder and Carol Burnett and wanting to be funny, but Hollywood, whenever they would cast me as, you know, the murderer, the Native warrior on the horse that didn't speak, the drug dealer, and I wasn't being allowed to be funny. So this was my first foray into that, to prove to people that I could be funny, that Natives could be funny. Again, it produced this spark in me that I wanted to do everything and anything in the movie business. And I was content with anything. Like on Young Guns 2, I held many jobs, not just stand-in photo double, but I worked for the grips, I worked for the cable pullers, I worked for costuming, I worked for set design, where I was shoveling horse manure. And I was just happy as hell, man. And people would just look at me like I was insane. And I was like, oh, no, I'm working on a movie. How many people in Tucson right now are working on this movie? It's a handful of us.
Yeah, and a big movie at that,
yeah,
you know?
A big movie at that. So I don't care what job they threw at me, I was willing to do it because I wanted to know what it took to make a movie from point A to point Z. Yeah. And Fusco, another thing he did was he allowed me to go into production meetings and to hear the producers talking and hear how the money was controlled and just how some scenes are taken out because they're too costly. It's not within the, you know, it's just amazing because it's a science. And it helped me understand that movies was more than just being a movie star, mm-hmm. you know, walking a red carpet and being famous. And, you know, of course, that's always the draw in the beginning. You're like, oh, I want to be famous. I want to be a movie star. I want to make millions of dollars. And then that slowly starts to get edged out by the art of it. You know, and the love, just the love of making something that's going to stand the test of time.
Yeah. It's just really cool to hear the stories that you have and the experiences that you have and that it inspires, and I'm sure it will inspire others who are listening to your story. So thank you for being so open about it, too. So what would you say are some of your career highlights?
My career, we'll start from the recent. The recent is, of course, Reservation Dogs.
Yes.
Reservation Dogs was just, I can't even describe it, man. It was a dream come true. And here's the story. I had done a couple of, like, four or five auditions, and I didn't get anything. Like, they never called my agent back. So I get this audition. She calls me up, and it's, like, a couple of days after I hadn't heard anything from other auditions. She goes, you have another audition. And I just kind of read the script a little bit, and I called a buddy of mine, and I thought, you know, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it this time. I'm not going to follow any of the rules. Again, back to rule breaking. Because there are rules with auditions that you have to follow. And I said, no, I'm not going to follow them this time. I'm going to do it exactly like I want to. And I changed lines, and I added dialogue, and I used props, and, you know, just everything you're not supposed to do. And I sent it to my agent. She's like, are you sure you want to send it like this? I go, yeah. She goes, John, you changed lines and Paul. And I said, I don't care. Just send it or don't. I don't care. You know, so she sends it. And then she calls me back a couple of days later. She's like, oh, my God, they loved it. And I was like, oh, well, that's neat. And she goes, do you know anything about this project? And I'm like, no. And she's like, I suggest you read the breakdown I sent you. So I go to the breakdown. And the first name I see is Taika Waititi. And I'm like, why does that name sound so familiar to me? And I look him up, and the first picture that comes up is him with an Academy Award. And I'm like, wow. Oh, my God.
Wow.
And then I see Sterling Harjo, and I'm like, I've done like three movies with Sterling, man. I know this guy, you know? Like, and again, I didn't quite know what it was. I knew it was a possible series, you know? I was auditioning for the part of Big, the cop.
Okay.
So weeks go by, and I'm like, okay, I didn't get it. Well, that sucks. And I'm driving to my job, you know, my crappy job, at 8:30 at night, and my agent calls me, and she's like, they're offering you the role. And I pull into the parking lot, and I was like, hold on. And I pull in. I'm like, what? And she goes, they're offering you the role. And she starts telling me, like, you know, she starts going, yeah, it's going to be a TV series, and this is for the pilot, and blah, 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 and Disney's behind it, and Hulu, and, like, she's throwing all this huge stuff at me. And my life, I feel my life is about to change. And Disney was trying to fight me being cast. They went to Taika and Sterling and said, hey, we want you to look at these other actors. And Taika took my audition. He goes, if you can find somebody funnier than him, we'll see him. And Disney saw it, and they were like, yeah, no, we don't have anybody. I was like, yeah. And 2 days before I'm supposed to fly out, Disney calls and says, hey, you need to take a COVID test. And I go and get a COVID test, and it comes back positive.
Oh, man.
And there's nothing wrong with me. And I go immediately take another one, and I have to wait for the results. We have to call Taika and Sterling and the casting director, and all hell's breaking loose. And they're, you know, Disney's like freaking out because this is at the beginning of COVID where everyone's just terrified of it. And now I'm, you know, quarantined in my apartment. Taika talks to Disney and says, listen, after he gets out of quarantine, we'll only miss 2 days of filming with him so we can, you know, kind of push the schedule. And Disney was like, no, he's got COVID and he's a liability. Recast the role. So Sterling calls me and he's like, dude, I'm so sorry, but we have to recast your role. And I was like, I was heartbroken.
Yeah.
Because I knew how big that role was. I knew how important that role was. And I knew the guy who they told me, you know, Sterling told me, he goes, yeah, we're gonna probably cast Zahn. And I'd known Zahn since the 90s. We came up in the business together. And that made me feel a little better because Zahn is just amazing.
Yeah.
He's an amazing cat. And he's a hardworking actor. And I thought, well, if anyone deserves it, it's that guy. Like, if they had cast some dude off the street, I would have been pissed off. You know? But Zahn, that's a different story. So that was a part of me that, you know, I was kind of happy about that. And it made me feel good that they had to get somebody that good, you know, to replace something I had done. And Sterling told me, hey, if we get picked up for a series, we'll come back for you. And a part of me is like, yeah, right. I'm going to come back. You know, Disney's going to get involved, you know, and they're going to have their actors. So long story short, they did get picked up for series. And Sterling had created this role, literally created this role for me because the role didn't originally exist. And I auditioned for it. And I had to audition like 12 times. And it was one of the hardest things I'd ever gone through. And the producers at Disney were just putting me through the ringer. And I asked Sterling, I'm like, what is going on? Normally, I've never done this like this. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, they're really worried because there's a whole episode where it's just you and your daughter.
Yeah.
And they need to know that both of you have what it takes to hold a show on your shoulders. And I was like, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you always think, yeah, I can do it. You know, the mountain's always smaller when it's far away. And then you get there and you're like, oh, my God, that's a huge mountain. But then I realized, like, I've never done a whole show. I've never been in a whole episode. So, you know, Disney had the right to do that, to test me. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the hardest acting tests I'd ever been through in my life. But it was something I was prepared for, that I had prepared for my whole life. Yeah. And so to me, it was challenging, and there wasn't any fear because I was like, yeah, keep testing me. Come on, let's do this, man. I was ready. So then again, weeks go by, and I'm like, oh, and at the end of the audition, what they did was each producer said, okay, we want you to do the scene, and this is the emotion I want you to make me feel. So each producer was doing that. So the last producer says, I want you to pick an emotion, do the scene, then tell us what the emotion was.
Wow.
Yeah. So I did it. And then at the end of that, they're like, good. And the screen went black. And I was like, oh, no, I lost my connection with Disney. And then Sterling called me. And I was like, dude, the screen went black. He goes, yeah, they do that. They just cut you off. He goes, you did great, man. And I was like, cool. He goes, all right, I'll call you later. Weeks go by. And I haven't heard anything. And I'm like, damn, I didn't get it. So then again, I'm driving to work at night, and my agent calls. I pick up, and she's like, "How you doing, Leon?" And I'm like, "Jenny, it's John. You called John." And she's like, "I know." She's like, "How are you doing, Leon?" I was like, "What?" It's like, "John, they're offering you the role of Leon." And I'm like, "What?" She's like, "Yeah." She's like, they want to cast you as Leon. You know, we had to sign this huge non-disclosure, so I wasn't allowed to tell anyone. But I couldn't say anything else. And people were calling me saying, "Hey, have you heard of this Reservation Dogs? And you should get cast in that, man. Call your agent." And I go, "Okay, I will." So then luckily I did the COVID test. Everything went good. And I got flown to Oklahoma. And it was just a dream. It was a dream come true to be working on something that huge. We didn't have any idea how big the series was going to be. We knew it was going to be popular with natives. We knew natives were going to love it. Mm-hmm. But anyone other than natives, we had no clue. And yeah. When I walked on set and saw all these actors that I had known throughout my career, you know, because we had all come up in the business together, it was so great. It was so beautiful. And there was a sad part of it because we'd lost so many native actors along the way that didn't get to be there, that probably would have been there if they were alive. And then there was this sudden fear because we were like, man, if we screw this up, we are never going to get another chance for a really long time. Yeah, Reservation Dogs has just been such a joy. And the response that we got, you know, after that, we all know what happened. And it was just amazing. And it felt so great to prove the world wrong, or at least people that didn't have faith in Native creativity and talent.
Yeah.
We proved everyone wrong, that we had been saying this for years, that, hey, we can play ourselves. Not only can we play ourselves, we can write scripts, we can direct, we can do all this stuff, just let us. And somebody gave us the chance and we hit a home run.
Yes.
And it was so gratifying and it was so beautiful. Some of the emails that I got were people telling me that my family had not spoken to each other for years. And Reservation Dogs brought us all together so we could all watch this together as a
Amazing.
Family. And people telling me that you remind me of my dad or my uncle mm-hmm. that used to take me hunting, and that episode meant so much to me. And Native fathers writing me saying, thank you for portraying a good Native dad. Mm-hmm. And Leon, he's a great Native dad. I mean, is he perfect? No. But he's just a guy trying. You know, he's just trying to be as good as he can, which, you know, all Native parents can sympathize with that. We're just mm-hmm. trying to be as good. I was a single father. Mm-hmm. You know, I had custody of my daughter when she was five. And I was always, you know, am I good enough? You know, am I doing everything right and raising this girl? And so all that awkwardness with Leon and Willie Jack in that scene was all from my, you know, when I remember having those conversations with my daughter as she was, like, coming out of being a little girl and slowly turning into a woman.
Yeah.
And it's kind of awkward, you know, to talk to your dad. So, yeah, Reservation Dogs is just
wow.
the shining star in mm-hmm. my life.
I mean, it was just amazing to see the how we related, how we connected, and to talk about it amongst our own peers and just laugh about it. The jokes, the Native humor that's in there is just funny. And just to have all of that represented, it was just amazing and super proud. And when I started to hear non-Natives, friends that were non-Natives, talk about it, I was surprised. I was like,
yeah.
Oh, wow, you know what that is? You're watching it? You enjoy it? You connect with it? That's cool. Yeah, brought a lot of people together.
No, and that was the amazing part. And it showed Natives everywhere that our stories matter. You know,
mm-hmm.
the humanity in our life mattered. Because for so long, the humanity part of our story was selectively edited out.
Yeah.
We were, in Sterling Harjo's words, we were always the zombies in westward expansion movies, cowboys, you know. The Natives were something, a force that had to be eradicated so mm-hmm. everyone could get to their beautiful homes that they're going to build and, you know, build America. We were that thing that needed to be taken care of. And they never explained why these people were so savage, why they fought so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And they took that humanity out of it. And for years, we've always been misunderstood. But now as you see the humanity and who we are, you know, that we were a people, we are a people, we're a beautiful people with a beautiful culture, and, you know, we're trying to preserve that culture. It's a stain on America, and it's something hard for America to swallow because the truth is so horrible, you know, that they try to systematically eradicate us. And that's the truth. There's no, I'm not painting this, yeah. You know, that is the truth, and mm-hmm. they're responsible for that. And until that is rectified, until our people are allowed to be who we were, you know, allowed to preserve our culture, our language, and allowed to thrive, you know, we're not going to stop, and we never have stopped. And that's a part of being Native that a lot of non-Natives don't understand. So that was the beautiful thing about Reservation Dogs. It broke that ceiling. It was the first one to just destroy the ceiling and open those doors wide open for, and now the community at large is just hungry for Native stories told by Natives, the real people.
Yeah.
The one controversy that always comes up is not hiring Natives to play Natives. And mm-hmm. people ask, you know, they have that thing like, well, it's called acting. You know, that person's just acting. Mm-hmm. They're not harming your people.
Yeah.
And I understand that from their perspective, but it's like, okay, well, here's something from our perspective. When you hire a Native, you don't realize what that does to a community. Like when they hired Johnny Depp to play Tonto, I was not happy with it. And I'm a huge Johnny Depp fan. Don't get me wrong. I love everything he does, except that role. But the one thing I try to explain to him is when Johnny Depp is done with this role, he's going to move on to his next role, like any other actor would. Mm-hmm. If it were a Native actor, that Native's going to take that fame and everything he's experienced back to the reservation, mm-hmm. back to his people. There's going to be kids that are going to see him at a speech somewhere or at a powwow. And they're going to say, wow, that guy went to school with my uncle. And if he can do it, mm-hmm. I can do it. Mm-hmm. That's what you're taking away from us, those pathways to success. And some reservations are so far out there. Like when I used to work at Baba Kivri in Sells mm-hmm. as a teacher. And I had done some movies. I hadn't done anything huge, but some mm-hmm. of the kids knew I had done movies. Mm-hmm. And they were like, what are you doing here? Why are you here? And I said, well, it's important that you guys see me, that you guys see that I'm a part of the community. I'm no different than you. You know, because there is nothing about me that's special other than I'm a pain in the butt and I don't quit. but I'm just like them. And I want them to see that. And that's the value in what you're doing. When kids see what you're doing. I mean, when you're an Indian kid growing up on a res, there's this gulf of separation between you, technology, opportunity, money, mm-hmm. that stuff is just a million miles away, mm-hmm. a million miles away. Yeah. But then when there's this, when somebody like yourself or myself or any, you know, person, any successful Native person comes and talks to kids, the gulf shrinks because they start to hear that, wait a minute, oh, that's how they did it. And it just didn't fall from the sky. Mm-hmm. Oh, they had to work for it. Oh, they were poor too. Oh, and it gives that confidence of like, maybe I could do this myself. Maybe whatever dream that is, you know, that's why it's so valuable to cast Native Americans in Native films. That's why it's so important for Natives to control the narrative of our stories.
What are some things that you advocate for, and what are some of those impacts that you feel you've been able to make?
Well, one of the biggest things, I was a Native American advisor and a counselor for many years, for about 30-some years of my life, and I worked with survivors of child molestation and violent youth offenders, and it affected me profoundly. I didn't want to do it in the beginning. That wasn't my plan, mm-hmm. and it just was kind of sort of forced on me, and I never forgot the kids who affected me, and I grew up with a pretty charmed life. I had really good parents. I didn't have to experience anything like that. Mm. And to see these kids, you know, and I buried about 19 children in my life. And I just, sorry.
No, no worries.
It's okay. I didn't want to forget them. And so when I thought of Tribal Force, I thought, you know, I just didn't want to make a comic book, you know? I wanted to make something that my people could understand. Kids that I met and saw and buried. I wanted to give them an opportunity to say, hey, that's me. That's something I went through. And, you know, maybe they won't choose suicide. Yeah. And that's why it's so important to me. Because these kids, the way they're treated, the way they've been treated, and the way communities treat them. Because I get it. Molestation is a horrible, horrible thing to talk about. It's an uncomfortable thing to talk about. And it's not easily solved. It takes money, it takes time, it takes people, it takes the community, and it's a wound, it's an open wound. What do you do with the perpetrators of child molestation? What do you do with the kids who have experienced this without further harming them psychologically? It's vast and it's massive, and I get the need to want to just brush it under the carpet and forget about it. And for a lot of communities, the easiest thing to do is get that kid out of here. Get him out of here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they let the perpetrators go. And the perpetrators, guess what they keep doing? They keep doing that. So my goal was to, you know, I dedicated a huge portion of my life to that. And I made some differences. And sometimes I couldn't. I had my hands tied. And the community wasn't receptive or the council wasn't receptive. So in this, in what I do here, it allows me to write about whatever I want to write about, mm-hmm. and expose this, you know, put the light of day onto it. And I'm hoping that some kids read it and they show an elder and they see that Nita's the main character. She's the main hero and she's the star of the book. And even though you've gone through that kind of abuse, that you're still special, you're still worthy of love, you're still worthy of relationship. Nothing has changed. Nothing. You're still a beautiful, beautiful person. And what somebody that you trusted did to you, that's not your fault, you know? And that's why I do what I do. And my hope is that Tribal Force will get big enough to where, you know, we can really do some damage to the numbers. Because 7 out of 10 girls will experience some form of molestation or violence in their lifetime on a reservation. There's 753 independent tribes in the United States today. Imagine what the numbers are. Yeah. So, anyway.
Yeah, and I'm sure, I don't know what the statistics are for young boys as well.
Oh, it's up there. It's up there. So it's something that our people need to talk about, need to communicate, and need to tackle, and need to put some effort and resources into it. That's why communities have to come together and decide, hey, this is how we as a community are going to handle it. Mm-hmm. Nobody can go in there and say, you need to do X, Y, and Z. The community has to make those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, yeah, you're right. Those conversations need to be had more openly.
Yeah.
In a comfortable place, in a comfortable situation. And yeah, it's still a long road in Native communities. We're not there yet.
No.
But to encourage the younger generation to openly, or even if they're an adult, to encourage them to openly talk, because it's, you know, providing a safe space or whatever that is, wherever that is. It just takes time.
Yeah, and I everywhere I go and give speeches and talk about Tribal Force, and when that subject comes up, invariably I get women mm-hmm. in their 30s, 40s, mm-hmm. and 50s that come up to me and tell me I'm a survivor. Mm-hmm. But back in my day, we didn't have any kind of counseling or anything like that, and it was something that they had to endure the majority of their adult life. Mm-hmm. And some of them eventually did get counseling, which is awesome. You know, but to meet these people that had to endure that, and, you know, it's just another, those, it's that, they're still that child. I still see that kid in them, you know, that had to endure that. And they're so happy to see that it's just, it's bold face. It's not a hidden thing. And I lost so many publishing agreements because they didn't want to talk about child molestation. And that's why it took me so long from 1996 to now.
Yeah.
Because publishers were like, you know, as soon as I started writing about it, they're like, yeah, we can't do this. And mm-hmm. I said, well, you knew when we signed the contracts, that's what this was about. You know, that's what the whole crux of Tribal Force is about. Mm-hmm. And it's not heavy-handed. It's not blatant. It's not like every issue we're going to talk about child molestation. But it's there, and it's going to be mentioned, and Nita's going to go through certain things that survivors go through.
Yeah.
And I want other kids to see this. I want them to see that as, oh, that's normal. That's normal to feel like that, to feel bad. It's normal to have good days and then have real horrible days. But this little girl experiencing it doesn't choose to take her life. She goes on, she moves on. And that's always been the one thing. It's, you always think back and you're like, could I have said something? Could I have done something? And Reservation Dogs handled that, you know, the suicide issue. Mm-hmm. And when you go through that, it leaves this hole in the community because everyone's wondering what they didn't do, what they didn't see. And it's so hard because it's hard to see. It's one of the main drives of Tribal Force.
Yes, a very important topic to talk about, and that you're doing it in a way that is definitely different.
Yeah.
But it's attractive, I feel like, you know, just the characters, what they stand for, you know, their backstories. So, you know, as we wrap up the interview, do you have any last thoughts or comments or even shout outs that you would like to share?
It's so weird being where I am because I've always been in Tucson and I've always been struggling and I was always in financial turmoil and I had gotten so many speeches from well-meaning speeches from people telling me that I needed to grow up and I needed to give this dream of Hollywood and comic books, you know, like go get a normal job, that'll fix everything. And I struggled for so long and then all of a sudden, you know, Reservation Dogs. And it changed my world in such a great way. And you have this thing, they call it, it's where you just don't feel you're worthy, you know? But then again, I've worked so hard to get to where I'm at that I'm glad that I finally got recognition. And to anybody who's listening, don't give up on your dreams. Doesn't matter how old you are. I'm 57. I got my big break when I was 54. And it's tough. It's tough. And, you know, but it's so fulfilling. I look back every now and then at my younger version and I'm like, man, I'm so glad you were so stubborn to hold on to your dreams. And that's what I tell young people. You're responsible for holding on to your dreams and feeding it and, you know, getting it to where it's got to go. And sometimes that means you're going to be broke. Sometimes that means you're not going to be the most popular person in the world. And so be it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John, for sharing your story and for being with us here at KXEI.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'm Tina Andrew, and you are listening to Cultivating Indigenous Voices, featuring Native Tucsonan, actor and comic creator John Proudstar. To hear more episodes, go to kxei.org.